From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, hired to get the lead pipes out of Flint last February. So why hasn't retired General Michael McDaniel been paid yet?
There was no plan set as to how he was going to get paid. No one knew. They figured, well, we'll figure it out later.
Michigan teachers taking a beating on the pay front to the point where one Algonac teacher is getting a house from Habitat for Humanity.
For me, it's like either get another job, which I've considered doing, you know, having a second job. But with coaching and stuff, you know, I don't get home until 7, 8 o'clock at night. So that would be difficult. And then less time with my boys as well.
And we meet the artist doing a huge fresco at Detroit's Cobo Center.
The process hasn't changed in over thousands of years.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for joining us today. Could storing stem cells when you're young and healthy help you live longer or even reduce the risk of disease as you get older?
You know, when you're younger, you have more of these circulating stem cells. The ones that you have are more effective at doing their jobs, which is bolstering your immune system, your bone and blood. So what we're doing is we're storing that ability that you have, which is amazing when we're younger, and diminishes as you get older.
We'll introduce you to the Ann Arbor company Forever Labs. But first, retired Brigadier General Michael McDaniel was appointed to lead the effort to get those lead water pipes out of Flint. That was back in February. Here we are, it's September, and McDaniel has yet to be paid one thin dime for his work. Bridge Magazine writer Ron French is here with the story. Ron, that appointment was made by Flint Mayor Karen Weaver 7 months ago. McDaniel was hired at a salary of $120,000 a year and not a penny since then?
Yes, that's right. Actually, when she appointed him, there was no plan set as to how he was going to get paid. No one knew. They figured, well, we'll figure it out later.
We'll get him on board, and he was willing to work with that.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and he has another source of income also. But it was a big commitment on his part, and he is the person who helped figure out how to get the lead pipes out in Lansing. He was the guy to hire, and it seemed like the absolute perfect thing for the city.
Mm-hmm.
That started in February. You come to May, there's still no pay. So this word gets to the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation about this, and the foundation steps in and says, look, this can't go on. We should pay this guy.
Because clearly the people of Flint want those lead service lines out, so that's such a top priority.
There's over a half billion dollars that has flowed into Flint or is coming to Flint, but yet everyone's still brushing their teeth with bottled water. You know, and so this is the number one priority, but yet it's where the least movement has been made. But anyway, so this had to be fixed. And so the foundation, you know, and the foundation world has been great with Flint, especially the Mott Foundation. They stepped in and said, we are going to give the city $120,000 to pay this guy for the next year.
Okay. Good news, you would think.
You would think. Okay. But that was May. The check actually got to the city in July. And the soonest he will get paid, if everything works out now, is mid-September. And that is because you have so many layers of bureaucracy and so many people who don't know, the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing.
So in meantime, if I read your piece in Bridge properly, Mott was thinking all along that McDaniel was being paid and discovered, I think through your phone call, that they discovered he had not been paid. They didn't know this.
The foundation thought when they sent a check that basically they would almost just walk it down the hallway and hand it to this guy. And that's probably what should have happened. But there's so many layers going on there. And it's so emblematic of the troubles that go on in Flint.
What did you think as you uncovered this story, Ron? Surprised?
Yeah, it was surprising. But then again, when we talked to people in Flint, people were unaware of it, but they almost shrugged their shoulders at it, including Mr. McDaniel, who sort of has been there for a lot of months and knows this is sort of how things operate. It's really, things are very slow, convoluted. Nothing gets done in a hurry here.
Well, in meantime, we know that there were somewhat 11,300 lead pipelines. And at this point, how many service lines have been replaced?
33. I know. And again, that's another problem in bureaucracy between the city and the state at that point, because they're arguing over how much money should be spent per house to fix these pipes.
So it is just a story that shows that people looking for change in Flint need to be very, very patient. Ron French, his story, How Long Will Flint's Water Chief Remain Unpaid, can be found in Bridge Magazine at bridgemi.com. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you.
We turn now to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. One might think, Daniel, with that white-hot glare of worldwide publicity trained right on Flint, something like this wouldn't happen. The man heading the push to replace those lead pipes not being paid. What does this tell us about how Flint works?
I think it tells us right now that there's an awful lot of strings on a lot of the money that's coming into Flint from the state, from foundations, and from other sources. You got state appropriations that have strings. You've got foundations that announce really big numbers, up to $130 million. And the assumption is that all that money drops on Flint's head. It doesn't. It's metered out over time. You've got city council approvals in the case of paying the general. And it's a new city council because they're now, in a sense, that they're coming out from underneath emergency management. You've got the receivership transition advisory board that also has to sign off on this. So there's a lot of these bureaucratic gates that everything has to go through. And it's an attempt to be accountable, and I understand that. But I think what you see is sometimes you can be so accountable that you've got somebody who's basically working for free for the summer, essentially. He was mm-hmm. working pro bono from like February to May or something like that, and now he's supposed to be paid for the summer, and he hasn't been paid.
Well, you got to wonder how much of this is just plain old incompetence.
Well, I think that's probably part of it. I think it's a lack of muscle memory. I mean, the city is trying to put itself back together. I mean, recognize, as I point out in the column today, that the city administrator was fired in May. They had a CFO who left in June, had only been there a year. The mayor is clearly trying to put her team in place. I don't think anybody begrudges that to her. But anytime you're doing that and looking for candidates, you know, there's a lack of what the general calls a lack of capacity. When I interviewed him, I talked about bureaucracy, and he said, well, you could call it bureaucracy. He said, I prefer to think of it as a lack of capacity, meaning we don't have the right people or as many people in the jobs we need to actually do the basics. And I think that's what people need to appreciate about a city like Flint right now, is that it's really in a multiple transition periods over a lot of different things, and one of it is how the city is run.
I want to talk a little about the Schuette investigation, which is not exactly proceeding at a lightning pace. We just learned yesterday that preliminary examinations for the 8 state employees who've been charged are not coming until next January and spread out through April. Mm-hmm. And the AG isn't ruling anyone out, including the governor. So how much of this is careful investigation, and how much do you think is politics?
Well, the Attorney General would tell you, and he said it many times publicly, that it's all careful investigation and no politics. The problem is that when you have an attorney general who clearly is running for the Republican nomination to become governor in 2018, it's hard to separate that. And frankly, it's hard to take that at face value. You know, I don't think there's any question that the attorney general is serious about trying to bring people to account. I think it's all very interesting that he refuses to exclude the governor or any of the people in his inner circle. And I can understand why he's doing that. But that is having an effect in the administration. I think there are people who are wondering who's going to be next, who's going to be named. And you look at the scheduling of some of this stuff. I mean, here you have guys who were indicted in April, and they're not getting their preliminary examination until January 2017. You know, somebody said to me yesterday, said, this thing is going to go on as long as Snyder is governor, and likely even farther down the road. It's a window into how our justice system works. I think there's some real frustration that the attorney general and his team are kind of taking their time here and really drawing this thing out. And that's having an impact on how the administration is able to help Flint and what it's able to do.
Daniel, when we hear the kinds of stories, for example, that Ron French broke, that here you have the retired general hasn't been paid all year. Mm-hmm. What does this tell us about Flint's recovery efforts in terms of how could people or foundations who say, you know what, I want to do the right thing, I want to donate money, help the city, how can they be certain that those donations are going to be appropriately used? I mean, if the city bobbled paying the water czar.
Well, you know, they did and they didn't. I think we have to recognize that there's a lot of constraints that are put on their ability to pay the bills and to use monies that are not necessarily their monies, like as in they're not city tax monies that they are then collecting and then deciding how to distribute. Their foundation monies, their state appropriation monies. And I think we would be having a different conversation if there weren't controls on some of, and conditions on some of those monies. But I think it says that this is going to be slow. You're going to see, and I think business, we haven't talked about the business community, but the business community is also ramping up to try and support small business efforts in the city of Flint, potential venture capital, private equity, small business lending programs. And they, too, are going to be looking at this, but it's not going to happen quickly. So I think this is going to be a slow process. But, you know, I am of the opinion that what's happening to Flint right now is actually a lot of it is opportunity. It's getting an awful lot of resources and an awful lot of attention that it probably otherwise wouldn't get for a city of barely 100,000 people as a result of this water crisis.
Yeah, we did talk about that. But clearly the opportunity is somewhat offset by, as you say,
right.
just the clunkiness of all of this.
I don't think there's any question. And I think you're seeing a lot of growing pains. You know, Mayor Weaver is new. She's new to the political game. And frankly, this is new for the state. I mean, they're really having to marshal a lot of resources and trying to be kind of multidisciplinary. I mean, you watch these Friday meetings online and they're like fingernails on a blackboard. It's so bureaucratic. And you've got all these different departments they're reporting in. And it's done very incrementally. And then you look at this and you say, that's why things aren't happening quickly. But there's a lot of reasons why it's not, and I think we're going to continue to see this, frankly.
Small comfort if you're a parent looking at the water coming out of that tap and worrying about what it contains.
I think that's right, although they are saying that the reports, mm-hmm. I saw Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech late in August said, you know, things are definitely trending in the right direction, and there will be some anomalous readings going forward, but they think they've got their arms around it in just in terms of the water quality.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaboration.
Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
Could the ancient search for the Fountain of Youth lead to Ann Arbor? Well, that's where a company called Forever Labs is working to solve the universal problem of getting old. Their solution, store your stem cells when you're a young adult and use them as you age. With us today is Stephen Klosnitzer, who's the CEO of Forever Labs, and President Mark Katakowski, who's also a funded staff scientist at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Mark, exactly what are you doing at Forever Labs?
What I do is I help people store their young stem cells, adult stem cells now, so they can be used later in life. One thing that we've learned and others have shown over this time is that as you grow older, the number of your stem cells diminishes and the function of them, the therapeutic potential of them diminishes over time.
So you're saying as we get older, the number of stem cells decreases. And what does that mean in our bodies and to our health?
So what it means is that there's a functional decline in the potential of those tissues. So for example, maybe in your bones, you know, as you grow older, your bones often become more brittle and less dense. And part of that has to do with the loss of bone-building stem cells. When you're younger, these are more active, and then as you grow older, they become more senescent. They turn off. Some of them actually just remove themselves. They die out altogether. And it's actually understood that that is a natural process that actually protects you from cancer because as cells grow older, they get damaged. A very bad thing is if you have a stem cell that is damaged and starts producing tissue aberrantly, you can end with a tumor growth. It's part of this natural process as cells grow older, the stem cells that have all this potential, that they start to decline in number and kind of turn off over time.
The idea of what you're doing at Forever Labs is exactly what, Steve?
What we're doing is essentially, I mean, you can think of it really as stem cell time travel. As Mark had mentioned, you know, when you're younger, you have more of these circulating stem cells. The ones that you have are more effective at doing their jobs, which is bolstering your immune system, your bone and blood. So what we're doing is we're storing that ability that you have, which is amazing when we're younger, and diminishes as you get older. So how we do that, we take your bone marrow and we isolate out your stem cells and we cryo-freeze them. We freeze them at a temperature that essentially renders them biologically inert. We outsource that with a company called Fisher Bioservices. They literally have their building shielded from radiation from space, which is basically the only thing at that temperature that could age these cells. As you age, your stem cells that we store stay young. For example, I'm 39 years old now. My stem cells are stored and are forever 38. So when I'm 65, 70 years old, I'm going to have access to my younger cells. I can reintroduce them into my body for any number of functions. I plan to hopefully be able to reintroduce these cells into my body when I'm still healthy to reconstitute my bone, blood, and immune system, thereby mitigating any chance of heart attack, stroke, potentially things like Alzheimer's disease. There's about 500 clinical trials right now that are utilizing these mesenchymal stem cells to treat any number of age-related diseases. That's what we're doing. We're the only people doing it. So
that's what I wondered as well. Okay. Yeah. Give us an idea of exactly what kind of conditions it seems that these stem cells saved from when we were younger could help as we get older.
Personally, I have been researching using them for neuropathologies, mainly for stroke, treatment of stroke, but also for treatment of MS and some other peripheral neuropathy.
What does the research show?
Well, actually, there was an interesting clinical trial that is being done in Stanford where they're using them for treatment of stroke, and they took patients that were fairly chronic. They had stroke within the last several months, and they injected these bone marrow mesenchymal stem cells around the infarct area of the stroke. They had actually quite a few of patients that responded quite well that actually gained function back that they had lost. The cells can promote healing after damage. There's clinical trials using them for heart disease. We have a heart attack, and they inject them along the infarct around the area that's damaged, and it promotes the healing, reduces the amount of scarring after. Mm-hmm. Also used for osteoarthritis.
Why can't we use a family member's stem cells?
You know, the chances are that for many applications, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but you could use a family stem cells. However, for example, if you're on the bone marrow registry and you have a perfect match, there's still a chance that, you know, your body's going to reject. With this, it's referred to as an autologous stem cell.
Your own, from you to
right,
you.
From you to you. And really, what could be more organic than young Cynthia treating older Cynthia? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea. To answer your question, there's probably plenty of opportunities where you could use these stem cells that you store for family members. But really, our core value proposition with Forever Labs is that you could use them for yourself. It's the ultimate insurance.
Therapeutically, they have kind of two ways that they can help. One is that they can support surrounding tissue. Stem cells are really good at helping healing and releasing a lot of factors that promote healing and reduce inflammation. In those cases, and there's plenty of clinical trials that use them in that way, someone else's stem cells, as long as they're well-matched, especially like a family member, they can help. But sometimes they're actually used to replace tissue. And when you want to replace tissue, for immunologic reasons, it's best to use your own. And you're really your own best donor. Even if you're using someone that's well-matched, over time, your body will tend to try to get rid of that tissue.
It recognizes this
right.
is not me.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes you need to take a strong medicine to fight that.
Okay. We have heard a lot of claims over the years that someone feels that they have tapped into the fountain of youth. How do we know that what you are doing at Forever Labs really, really works?
This isn't the end-all, be-all,
sure.
But there is a lot of wonderful applications that these are going to be used for in the future. And if you went to the website, you'd see a list of all the trials right now mm-hmm. and all the hard science behind it. So it's already working. What we're doing is we're credentialing orthopedic surgeons and plastic surgeons. In Michigan, we have Dr. Laith Farjo. He's an orthopedic surgeon. He's fantastic. He's our chief medical officer. Dr. Farjo has been using these cells to help treat patients that have problems with their bones and joints and things like that and regrow tissue. This stuff's already happening in clinic. Mm-hmm. It's same day. You take stem cells. In lieu of surgery, often they'll reintroduce it. So it's already working in many applications. Where Forever Labs really comes in is that we will allow you to store them now so that you can have that same sort of advantage when you're older. Because let's say you have a bad knee when you're 70 years old and you want to have it done. Your 70-year-old stem cells really aren't going to do much for you at that point. However, if you had access to your, you know, 45-year-old, 50-year-old stem cells, it really could be an advantage.
That's actually part of the reason why we started this is what happens if you just simply do a transplant of young bone marrow from a young animal to a genetically etched older animal? Some other groups have done this study. And what they found is that when you simply transplant young bone marrow to a genetically matched older animal, the animals live significantly longer. I said to Steve, I said, you know, this is something I want to do myself. For myself and for my family, I want, you know, my wife has done this as well. And there is this enticing idea that maybe over time you could not only just treat your unhealthy self, but you could actually treat your, you know, healthy self to live longer.
To yeah. stay healthy longer
yeah.
and have a better old age.
I mean, there's some serious ifs there, but yeah. it's not beyond the realm of possibility.
What does this cost and who gets access to this
sure.
kind of banking and this possible treatment?
We want this to be accessible to as many people as possible. Just to be really frank, it's $3,500 to have the procedure, and it's $250 a year to store it. That is us getting as close as we can to do it in a way that is sustainable as a business, but is also accessible to as many people as possible.
It's not unlike umbilical cord blood storage. A lot of parents do that for their child. It's a very similar, you know, cost. And
it raises the question, could you be creating a group of people that could access this treatment for a better old age and then those who are left out?
Yeah. And, you know, frankly, we come from middle class families and I want my family to be able to do this. You know, I'm not interested in creating an elite class of citizenry that can live forever and other people cannot.
If indeed these clinical trials and the work you're doing in labs proves that these stem cells, this time-traveling stem cell idea works, it is significant when you think of the medical costs that could be saved through one's life if you can
absolutely
be more vibrant and have a younger acting body and a body that can heal itself.
Sure. My wife's a physician, and everyone talks about preventative medicine. We don't want to be reactive in medicine, and a lot of medicine is moving in that direction, and I'm confident that we're a part of that. So you ask what the best age for having the procedure done is, and the answer is the same as when is the best time to plant a tree, 20 years ago or today? And that's the answer with Forever Labs as well. If you're 18 years old, you can have the procedure done, and that would be the best time to do it. We've had people as old as 63 years old having the procedure. And we say after 60 that you take, you know, special precautions with your physician. But really, there will be appreciable benefits to, I think, anyone.
Looking in the laboratory studies, the functionality and the number of the cells, there is, like many things, there's a lot of variability between individuals. So you might have a 30-year-old, you know, who's the function and number of stem cells in their bone marrow might be lesser than that. Somebody's a 40, that's, you know, maybe due to genetics or maybe just how they take care of themselves. Yeah, over time, of course, there is, you know, I'm 41 and I had mine taken out when, you know, 5 months ago. When I'd like to think my stem cells are 5 months younger than me now. yeah, I think, like Steve said, that There is a point, we're not going to push somebody that's 80 or 90 years old.
All right. Mark Katakowski and Steve Klosnitzer of Forever Labs. Thanks so much for being with us and introducing us to the idea of time-traveling stem cells.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
One of the world's most famous examples of fresco art is the Diego Rivera work at the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Detroit Industry Murals. In that very same tradition, Detroit artist Hubert Massey is preparing to paint a large mural in the fresco style in Detroit's Cobo Center. It'll tell the story of Detroit. Hubert Massey, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
This is no small undertaking. How large will this mural be?
Well, it's going to be approximately 30 feet by 30 feet.
Hubert, tell us, what is the story that you want to tell through this fresco for Cobo?
Well, one of the things I want to tell through the fresco is the sort of like a quick snapshot of the history of the city of Detroit. So it starts off with a guy who's holding the earth in one hand, and then there's a mechanical arm that stretches up and over him, shine the light down on the earth, but his hand is reached out in the center of a gear. So what is it doing? Is creating the center of technology and innovation. And it also shows a Native American that's standing up on the sort of a cliff looking over the Detroit River. You'll see the Ambassador Bridge. You'll also see the new bridge that's supposedly that's going to be built, and you also see where the Indian is pointing their hand. There's a canoe that's going upstream, and also a freighter that's coming downstream. And then you also see the city. Detroit happens to be a tapestry of many different cultures that's in the landscape, from Native American, Hispanic, African Americans, and so on. You also see the landscape of Canada on the other side of the river.
When you got this commission, I'm interested, Hubert, what's the process where it begins as this germ of an idea, tell the city of Detroit's story, and then what do you do to develop it into this really clearly glorious, all-encompassing array of images?
Well, one of the things... I normally do community forums. So we got a group of people from kids to community leaders and sort of a cross-section throughout the city to come together and to discuss what would be some of the things that if somebody was coming to the city for the first time, what would be some of the iconic things that we will want the viewer to see for the first time coming to the city that tells them the story of the city of Detroit.
Which makes sense because you're talking about the heart of Detroit's convention visitor scene.
That's right, and sitting on the international border. So we have these discussions, and a lot of times people come up with really wonderful stories and all. And, I get inspired by that.
Hubert, take us through the process. You don't just get up there and start drawing and painting on this huge space, this basically 30 by 30 foot space. So what's the actual process of creating a fresco mural?
Well, one of the things is that after the sketches and the design is created, then there's what you call a cartoon drawing that has to be produced. Now, I studied up under Diego Rivera's assistants. They're the ones who taught me how to do frescoes, and this happened back in the mid-90s or so. So part of the process is that when you create these cartoon drawings, they have to be full scale. We take tracings from that, and then take tracings from the actual drawing that we create that's full scale. Then you perforate the tracings. So a long time ago, they used to use sticks or some kind of a wood with a pen or metal tube that they can just poke holes into it. So in this day and time, we use electricity. Electricity arcs. So we have a wall that's screened, and as fast as you move your tool, thousands of holes are already into the paper. I got this because I was a sign painter. And that's what really intrigued me about doing frescoes, because Diego Rivera was a sign painter too. So this is really intriguing to me because I like the logistics that go along with doing the fresco. So once you do the cartoon drawing, once you have perforated the paper to transfer it onto the surface, then the hard work begins. You have to grind pigments. So pigments are all hand ground. There's no paint that you go to the store and buy and it's already in liquid form and you start painting. You have to actually make your own pigments. Then you have to prepare the wall. That involves structural engineers, because if the wall cannot support the weight of a fresco, then that wall has to be rebuilt in order to house the fresco. So what's the materials? The materials are made out of river sand, lime, marble dust, and oxidized pigments.
I have to say, it strikes me that what you're describing, do you think of the fact that you're doing something, Hubert Massey, that we know that there are murals and frescoes on cave walls from prehistory. Do you feel linked to these, eons of artists?
Oh, yeah, I feel very much so. I mean, because the process hasn't changed in over thousands of years. Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel. It's the same technique, the same process. Did you know when you paint black and white first, and then you paint the colors over the top of that? That's that's truly amazing, and that's where you get the when people say, "Well, I'm glazing." Well, glazing comes from basically frescoes, because that's all it is running color on top of color on top of color, which colors bleed through.
It sounds stunning and painstaking beyond belief, but when do you expect that the piece will be completely finished, Hubert?
It should be completed by the end of next year.
Oh, boy. And I know we want to let everybody know there will be an unveiling of Hubert Massey's cartoon drawings for this Cobo Center fresco that's happening this evening at Cobo from 5 to 7 p.m. It's open to one and all, so we could really get a chance see these incredible images telling Detroit's history that you tell. And then about a year from now, we'll be talking about being able to see the final product, Hubert.
And I'm pretty excited. And so and then it sort of goes along with some of the other pieces that I have around the city. It's probably about 15 monumental pieces around the city of Detroit, from everywhere from the tile mural in Southwest Detroit to the Athenaeum Hotel, mm-hmm. the murals I painted there, the African American Museum floor, the Paradise Valleys, Terrazzo, Campus Martius. So, and that's just a few.
Making his mark on Detroit through his art. Hubert Massey, it was great to hear you describe your love of art and your talent with us, and we want to thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you so very much. I'm truly honored.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You decide to become a teacher because you want to help, to see your students grow and learn. Yet, look at teacher pay and you'll discover teachers are indeed taking a beating on the pay front. A new study from the nonprofit Economic Policy Institute finds that in 2015, the weekly wages of public school teachers in this nation were 17% lower than comparable college-educated professionals. And who's hit the hardest? Male teachers and longtime veteran teachers. So while college grads saw their average weekly wages go up from 1996 through 2015, public sector teachers saw their wages shrink. Well, Jeff Smith sure knows what that's like. The 43-year-old is a longtime teacher and coach for Algonac Community Schools in St. Clair County. Money is so tight, Jeff has been chosen to get a Habitat for Humanity home. Jeff Smith, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Jeff, how long have you been a teacher?
This would be my 17th year teaching.
Time flies when you're having fun. You had to stop and kind of think about that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it goes by quick, that's for sure.
What do you teach?
Currently, I teach alternative ed, and I have a history major and minor, but I'm doing alternative ed right now at the high school, Algonac High School.
And you also coach?
Yes, I coach. I'm the defensive coordinator on the varsity football team, and I also coach varsity softball.
Well, the figures from that new Economic Policy Institute study that show how public teachers like you, public school teachers, have seen that wage gap balloon since 1994. Tell us, what has that been like for you? How have you seen your pay change since you started teaching 17 years ago?
Well, when I first started, you know, you were on steps. And so every year you get a pay increase. And then, you know, the last 4 years or five, we've seen our steps being frozen. So our pay does not increase, and we stay where we're at. Even if we have a master's degree, even if we go back to school and get further on education, our steps stay the same. So that's the glaring thing that we've seen, that our pay has been frozen because of all the cuts going on and because of the lack of funding, you know, for schools. So.
And then in 2011, we had Public Act 152 that was passed, which limits, we'll remind everybody, that limits the amount of money that districts can contribute to employee health care. What has that meant for you, Jeff?
Yeah, that's been huge as well. I mean, just this summer, my increase in health insurance went up $170. So, you know, it seems like all the costs are going up, but our pay is declining. And so that's been difficult. But, yeah, the cap has been tough because, you know, schools are not putting as much money in, and so now we have to inherit that. And we are putting, you know, a lot more of our money in. Our checks are getting smaller and smaller.
So wages aren't going up for you. They're stagnant. Healthcare costs and pension contributions have gone way up. What has that meant for you really on a day-to-day basis of trying to make ends meet? In terms of dollars and cents and in your standard of living, I mean, what you're able to afford for yourself and your two sons.
Yeah, well, more money's taken out of my check, you know, it seems like. And, again, $170 was taken out, you know, this summer. On top of everything else, that's been difficult. And so for me, you know, paying rent and paying my bills and having a cell phone, it's been very difficult. And so for me, my parents have inherited some of my costs. They pay for my cell phone bill and some of my insurances as well, for my car insurance. And so, you know, it's just difficult. It's just tough when you got two boys, and I have them every weekend, you know, week on, week off. In the summertime, we have joint custody, and so I get those guys. And they're, you know, growing. They're 9 and 8 years old, and they're eating like, you know, machines. So, you know, grocery bill is pretty expensive. And but again, it's, you know, our checks are smaller, and so because of that, you know, my parents have inherited some of my costs.
Somehow, I suspect neither you nor your parents expected that when you were 43, they'd have to be helping you with, you know, cell phone and other costs.
No, that was not on the list for sure. That's, you know, but fortunately, I have them. But yeah, it's. For me, it's like either get another job, which I've considered doing, you know, having a second job, but with coaching and stuff, you know, I don't get home until 7, 8 o'clock at night. So that would be difficult, and then less time with my boys as well. So, you know, it's not a viable option for me to have a second job. So
I've got to ask and put this out here. Have you thought of getting out of teaching? I mean, why stick with teaching?
Well, you know, I've told everybody this, but and it's from the heart. But it's what I love doing, and it's what I enjoy doing. And I think I make a huge impact, a positive impact on kids' lives. And in college, I tried the business side of things. I tried sales, and it just wasn't for me. I love helping people, and it's very rewarding for me. And I don't need to make a whole lot of money. I just need to pay my bills is all I would need to have. And my reward in life is helping people succeed. And, I do alternative ed, and I've got some kids that are, from low-economic families and things, and they don't have a whole lot. And for me to, I kind of help these kids maybe get to college, for me, that's a win. That's what my life's all about. It makes it all worthwhile just to help one or two kids maybe, succeed. And that's why I'm still in the profession.
I'm speaking with Jeff Smith, who is a veteran teacher at Algonac Community Schools in St. Clair County, who is soon to receive a home through Habitat for Humanity. So let's talk about that housing situation, Jeff. Where have you been living? What's that been like?
Well, I'm in transition right now. I'm living with one of my coaches, his family right now in the loft for the next probably 7 to 8 months until the house is completed. So, and that's been an interesting transition, too, with football going on and school starting up here, too. It's going to get pretty hectic. Mm-hmm. But the Habitat program has been wonderful all summer. I have put in what's called sweat equity hours. And what that is basically is you have to put in 50 hours of volunteer time to work on other houses, other owners that are in the Habitat community there. And I go, I've done drywall. I've done laid carpet. I've done all kinds of different odds and ends jobs all summer. And it's been a great experience for me helping other people that are in my situation. And it's been very rewarding for me.
And what will you be getting from Habitat for Humanity and when?
Well, it's a house. It's a pre-existing house here in Algonac. It's on Market Street. And it's a 90-year-old home, but they go in and they just basically gut the whole thing out and they demo it and then they build you basically a brand new house. So for me, it's an upgrade because I lived before in a one-bedroom house, and I've got two boys. They shared a room. I lived in the dining room. That was where my room was at with a curtain drawn, and that was my wall. So for us now with a three-bedroom house now, my boys each get their own rooms, which is going to – I mean, they're really excited about that.
What did it mean? How did it feel when it all clicked in and you realized that you were going to get a house from Habitat?
I just felt very it's very emotional, first of all, and I just felt very honored. And it was like a second chance at life for me. It was a game changer for me, and it's been just a wonderful thing. And like I said, the boys and I were really excited, and it's changed our lives, obviously in a very, very positive way.
Now, you're the second St. Clair County teacher to get a house or Habitat for Humanity. I guess I'm wondering about your thoughts. What does it say about teaching in Michigan that we have the Michigan Education Association teaming up with Habitat for Humanity to help teachers who can't afford a house?
That's a good question. I know that with the MEA, and they've been very, very supportive. I've met with them, and it seems to be a reoccurring theme. And it's a lot of teachers now that are qualifying for this. And, in a way, it's very sad, but, in other parts, it's all these people coming together. It's not just Habitat for Humanity. It's been the MEA. It's been teachers in the district here. It's been administrators as well, even some administrators. But, it's coming together as an entire, family here. And it's rewarding in the same token, but it's very sad that, that we qualify for this.
What do you hope, Jeff, might change for teachers all through Michigan? If you could talk to the policymakers in Lansing who are making these decisions, what would you hope they would understand?
Well, the biggest thing is I know other countries, teachers are valued, in some countries they're like doctors. And it just seems like here teachers get a real bad rap for whatever reason. And, it's like any profession. You've got your good, you've got your bad. And, the good teachers, the ones that are get there early in the morning and stay until 7 o'clock at night, helping kids because they're truly about the kids. I just feel like, we get shortchanged and, we should get just some respect in that matter because there are some great teachers out there that really spend a lot of time. And if you break it down with coaching, for example, and teaching, you know, you're making literally like pennies an hour. I mean, you really are. And so, I just want the respect there. I don't necessarily care about money, but I really care about, you know, teachers should get respect. The good teachers should have some respect, and you know, especially from lawmakers as well. But you know, that's what I want to see, and I hope that, you know, that changes here in the near future.
Jeff Smith is a veteran teacher and coach in Algonac Community Schools in St. Clair County. He will receive in a few months a home from Habitat for Humanity. Jeff, good luck to you, and thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Why mess with success? That seems to be the philosophy as a venerable Flint company marks its 100th anniversary this year. Kogel Meats is a century old, and the company's still making its products the same way with the same ingredients as it did on day one. And Kogel's has stuck with Flint through good times and bad. John Kogel is the president of Kogel Meats. John, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
100 years ago, how did Kogel's end up getting the start in Flint?
My grandfather, who learned the meat business in Germany through the apprenticeship program, he came to the United States. He ended up in Milwaukee for a couple of years, but always wanted to do his own thing, own his own business. And he, an armor salesman, which was supplying the plant that he was superintendent of at that point, he asked him, he said, you know, if you want to do something, you ought to move to Flint, Michigan, because the auto industry is going to boom there. And indeed, that's what my grandfather did.
My goodness. I've got to imagine, if I think about 100 years ago, delivering meat and keeping it from spoiling back in those early days, that had to have been tough. I mean, refrigeration was really a challenge. How did they do it?
Well, they delivered to most of the retail markets on a daily basis. Grandfather would take ice blocks. They'd move them into the basement during the winter, you know, cover them in sawdust. That was how he kept the plant somewhat cold. And then they would take the trucks out on a daily basis to the stores and deliver to them 6 days a week.
Now, the company, here we're talking about a company that has been around for 100 years. Certainly, there's been many changes in our world since then, but here it is amazing to think that the recipe hasn't changed.
No, we've had, you know, 4-5 generations eating it. We talked about it, years ago, should we do something and maybe chase price? And we decided, nope, if somebody wants the best, we want to serve them the best. And so from that point on, we've decided that we are just going to continue on the way Grandpa made the products back then, and we're going to keep the same, many of the same processes and the same flavor profile.
Now, for you, how did you get your start in the family business? I mean, did you always want to do this, or did you have an urge to go off and do something different?
Well, to get the start in the family business, I started out here, you know, doing some special projects, mowing the lawn, washing some walls, doing different things like that. And at the age of 14, I started working in the summers full-time back in what we call our kitchen, putting the product together. I always did like the business, but I really didn't know if I wanted to go into it until really my freshman year of college, and then whether it was an aha moment or just thinking, you know, that would probably be fun to go back into that line of work and the possibilities that it presented to me were really open-ended. I could take it where I wanted, and so at that point in time, I really decided that I will come back into the business, and my father let me come back, and it all has worked out. So.
Now, Kogel products are sold all over Michigan, and then we've got Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and I am sure that you have had people over the years say, hey, take the brand coast to coast, but that is something that you've chosen not to do?
No, not necessarily. You know, we tried to expand. We are in, of course, with Meijer in the outlying states, which mm-hmm. you've mentioned. But it's very hard to get someone to try a new product, to get a meat buyer in a particular grocery chain to try a new product. And so what we decided was we were trying to push out and do different things. And at one point I just decided, you know, let's just pull back. We'll sell less product, probably make a little bit more money, because I was looking at that more like an R&D expense, trying to push the product further. And just decided we're going to be the best meat company in Michigan.
Now, the Flint area that has been home to Kogel Meats for this century, as we all know, it's taken a lot of hard economic hits since your grandpa first opened the company. Certainly losing General Motors was a huge hit. What did it take for Kogel Meats to stay put, not pull up stakes, not pull out of Flint?
Well, this is certainly our hometown. This is our core area. You know, like I mentioned, 4 and 5 generations have probably been eating the product. And so as we move away from Flint, our market share drops a little bit. But it's also, there was a chance, as we moved into Grand Rapids and things, the chance for growth. And so indeed, that's what we did. in 1985, when I came into the business, I was put in charge of sales, and I said, boy, if we ever have another downturn like we had in the early 80s, we're going to be really hurting, and so let's try to push out as much as we can. And indeed, that's what we did. We started, we were already in some of the Kroger stores, some of the Meijer stores, and they allowed us into the stores that we were not in. And so we just continued to expand and push out, and that has allowed us to stay right here in Flint and enjoy success throughout those years.
There is, I understand, quite an example of being a local business that goes above and beyond for its customers. Did I read occasionally you've been known to fly products to customers with your own plane?
Well, I'm a private pilot. It's not the way we like to deliver product, but sure, a couple times somebody might have a sale item or a food service person that might need product immediately, and that if it's, you know, further away, say a couple hours, then yes, I have been known to do that.
John Kogel, president of Kogel Meats, marking its 100th anniversary this year in Flint. Thank you so much for speaking with us, John.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to move up to the Canyons, baby. I'm going to pay my...
And before we go, let's dig into the mailbag. Michelle from the Kalamazoo area wrote in after our conversation Tuesday about rising tuition costs and declining state investment in Michigan's public universities. In her email with the subject header, "College Tuition Doesn't Go to Professors," Michelle writes, "I did the math for this upcoming semester, and for $100, each student of mine receives about 4 hours of classroom time a week. That's $1.66 for an hour of my time. That's like a pack of gum. These are all symptoms of a deteriorating educational system." On August 30th, we discussed the pros and cons of dental therapists, a new professional position that is being considered by our legislature to help address the limited access to low-cost dental care in some parts of Michigan. Anne from Bay City wrote us and said, "I wish you'd talk to someone from the Michigan Dental Hygienists Association. It's always interesting to me when dentistry wants to let hygienists practice with more independence in underserved areas, but not in regular practice. In my opinion, this is because dentists don't serve in those areas because they can't make money, so we'll send the girls to do it." Back on August 22nd, we discussed the controversial electroconvulsive therapy, also known as electroshock therapy, and its effectiveness for certain mental illnesses. And we got a number of emails criticizing our handling of this issue. One of them came from Beth in mid-Michigan, who wrote, "I hope you'll further explore this topic with more in-depth questions about the dangers, especially the side effects. Your interviewee made this sound like a totally safe treatment with absolutely no side effects." If you have a comment or any question, we would love to hear it. Just send us an email right to stateside@michiganradio.org. Today's program was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Ryan Grimes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.